Today in part 7 of the series Building a Marriage, the topic is embracing maleness. How does belief in God affect a man's heart? What does the Bible say about building a man's impact, strength, and love? What can derail our masculinity? And how does a man avoid becoming a counterfeit of manhood? Here's Pastor Seth.
We are doing you might think we're doing a series on Monopoly. I love our Monopoly cards. I was telling Chris and Tasha when they were bringing in our card for today that I grew up playing Monopoly with my family. And so every time I see, I think of, you know, these characters are just iconic in my mind. You know, it goes back a long time. I love seeing them up here, and they are such great visuals for us as we think about each one of these represents one message, you know, 30 or 35 minutes of God's instruction to us about marriage. Last week we talked about embracing femininity, and today we're talking about embracing masculinity. And I need to say to you, there are a lot of Sundays where the messages that that I give, some of them are easier to do, and others are harder to do. Sometimes it feels like I'm preaching more to myself than I am to you, although you usually don't maybe sense that. But this is particularly true for me. So when you hear me speaking about masculinity, do not assume too much about me. Do not assume that just because there's information that I know, that I'm just sort of just wildly putting it into practice and doing so great on this topic. Because, as you're going to see, I struggle with a lot of these things, just like you guys do too. So I hope that you'll hear me preaching to myself today, and in some ways, a fellow struggler. Gender is one of those things that is tremendously confusing in our Western culture, not just in the U.S., but also in Western Europe. There are all kinds of things that in the last 10 or 20 years you thought you would never hear in the news and people. But I would like to tell you just sort of my story growing up as a metaphor for how it's possible to get very confused about gender, both personally and then as a culture. When I was about 4 or 5 years old, my first recollection of what I wanted to do when I grew up, which that's what I understood growing up, and I want to equate that with when I become a man. Okay, now I didn't understand man or manhood, but that's all I understood, was when I grew up, I wanted to be a professional baseball player. I wanted to be Roberto Clemente with the Pittsburgh Pirates, right fielder. I wanted to bat like him and catch like him and steal bases like him and run like him. And that was sort of what my heart said without me knowing it was, that's manhood. That's what it means to be a man. And my heart said, sounds, without me knowing it again, sounds good. And then somewhere along the line, I watched football with my dad, and I thought, saw my dad be real excited about football players, and I was pretty fast, and I thought, and my heart said, manhood, you could do that. And I kind of went, huh, yeah. Now again, not that I understood those concepts or understood those terms, but there was something in my heart sort of moving or gravitating towards different definitions of manhood without me even knowing that was true. The one thing I did not question in grade school or junior high was, huh, I wonder what God's design of manhood is. Well, of course, was never on my radar. What I was looking for, without knowing it, was a definition of manhood that I liked, or that was manageable, or that I could live up to, or that I could enjoy, or I could be successful at, and particularly, again, without knowing any of these things, but did not require any kind of sacrifice or courage or movement. Now, when I got into about junior high, I was the shortest kid in my class, and though I was really, really fast, I was also the skinniest kid in my class, and I began to sense that my future was not in professional football. And without knowing it, again, my heart just sort of said, the sinful side of my heart said, no problem. Got something else for you. Manhood is to be like your dad and be successful in business. And again, without knowing it, my heart just sort of, huh, Just kind of jumped on that horse and rode that for a few years until about my junior year in high school. And I watched my dad go off to work between 7 and 7:30 in the morning and come home 9:30 or 10 at night. And the idea of being away 60 or 70 hours a week in an office did not sound as romantic as it did when I was in junior high. And my heart, and I sort of like, I think I need something different. Again, not me knowing it. And the sinful side of me said, no problema. Got something for you. Party animal. So I launched into that for a couple years in high school. Didn't require any courage, any strength, any movement towards other people. Didn't require any responsibility or deep connections with people. But my heart was just sort of saying, that's what manhood looks like. Now, I went away from high school, about a 3-hour drive to a college on purpose. And the reason was, I wanted to go to a school that didn't know me when I was short, and didn't know me when I was skinny, and didn't know me when I had buck teeth, and didn't know me when I had braces on my teeth. And when I went to college, my heart said, we got something new for you. Get the girl. Get the pretty girl. And I kind of went, huh. And again, not that I understood any of these things. They just were happening. The thing I didn't ask was, I wonder what God's design for manhood is. I just went after the images of manhood that were either manageable, comfortable, that I sensed I could do well at, that didn't require any kind of courage or strength or certainly sacrifice or depending on God. Now, I came to Christ in the middle of my junior year in some ways because my search for what I now look at as manhood or completion or personhood finally ran into some cul-de-sacs. None of the things that I'd picked were really working for me. My heart was still looking for something else. Now, in some ways, that is a metaphor or a parable for a lot of how our human heart, even as children, can sometimes you hear things like, but I've always been a, it feels like I've always been a, I was a girl in a boy's body, or I was a boy in a girl's body. It never really felt any different. Now, what I'd like to say is there's something in tune with my story, and then usually underneath that, not always, but not uncommon, is a current of either some bad gender models or bad gender experiences or some physical abuse or sexual abuse. Not always, but at least those categories of things are things that we ought to be thinking about in terms of how God made us. The thing that we is so hard for us to do is the first word in our title, is to embrace the masculinity that is inside of me. As we talked about last week, let's go to our next slide. Last week we said that we are gendered as people. We have a gendered heart. That's not very popular in the Western world today. But in Genesis 1, God said, let us make human beings in our image to be like us. And here the idea is that we are deeply, fundamentally relational in nature. That's woven into our DNA. It's what distinguishes us from the animals. We were designed for deep connection. God created human beings in his image, in the image of God, he created them. Male, the Hebrew word zakar, and female, nekeba, which you looked at last week, he created them. At the same time that Adam and Eve are made, interwoven here are two great concepts. We are made in the image of God, and we are gendered. Now, it doesn't matter if people feel that that's true, or their senses that's true. Those things can be explained by some of the things that I mentioned in the introduction to this message. What is true is down deep in the recesses of our heart, we are gendered people. And if it's hard to understand that or hard to feel that, there are reasons that have to do with our experiences and present fear that sort of hide that and push those things down of things I don't want to look at or face. As we look at masculinity, there are a number of verses I'd like to look at. The same verse, we are made for impact. Let's go to the next slide. What is manhood? What is masculinity? And we see it in this word zakar. Male, zakar, and female, he created them. The word zakar means to make a mark or impact. Or if you're in the parking lot and you open your car door a little bit too early and you make a little ding or a dent in the car next to you, that's zakar. It's a very common word. And then it came to be used in the Hebrew culture of a position of a cabinet member of a king. And the role of the zakar was somebody close to the king, like an assistant, whose duty was to remember the important things the king was to do and to help him move to do something about those important things. Now, this is the day, this is the time, of course, before Franklin Day planners and your to-do lists, you know, and your iPhone that has all these, you know, these lists of things to do. The king had all kinds of things he needed to remember, and the zakar was somebody whose job was to remember and to help the king move. So our first indication of something of what manhood looks like. The Hebrew scriptures were translated into the Greek several thousand years ago, and the Greeks used the Greek word arson, not with an O, but with an E, A-R-S-E-N, to describe this word, and they use it as lifting something heavy or carrying something heavy. Which goes into, which is along in line with the next image here of moving with strength. Manhood has something to do with moving strongly, remembering what's important, and moving strongly towards this. Now, one of my favorite pictures of this is King David, who was a tremendous king, a very powerful king, and in some ways very successful king. And the people, for the most part, loved King David. But as he was on his deathbed, there were several of his sons that were trying to become king. And they were wanting to become the guy. And there was some dysfunction in the family. And on his deathbed, Bathsheba, with whom he had had adultery with years before, comes to him and says, one of the other sons wants to be king, and you promised Solomon he'd be king, and you need to do that. And David quickly had brought Solomon in, and on his deathbed assigns him to be the king and take over the throne. And he gives him his sort of last deathbed words. Very short little passage in 1 Kings 2. But the essence of it is this verse, is this, these words here. He says to Solomon, be strong and show yourself a man. He equates manhood with something to do with strength. The question is, what does he mean? Well, if you've ever led anything, whether it's in government or business or in your neighborhood or at school, leadership is not an easy task. It's much more difficult than when before you become one. And so the question I think about is, well, did King David realize that Solomon was going to have a hard time dealing with kingship? I suspect that Solomon probably would. I mean, how would you like to follow King David? If I was Solomon, I would think, well, you know, King, my father, King David, wore size 13 shoes, and it seems to me I wear about size 3. I'm not sure I can really do this. There's going to be a need for strength to handle the weight of this particular job. Is that all he meant there? Be strong and show yourself a man? And I don't think so. We're not told exactly what he meant, but this is what I think he's telling his son, Solomon. He's saying something along those lines. You grew up in a home where your father, like many in the culture of the time, wrongly had many wives. He had a handful of wives. And there are people that don't study the Bible that say, see, the Bible talks about, endorses multiple marriages. No, it doesn't. Those examples are in there to say this is truly a moronic idea. Please do not do this. And what David did with his handful of wives was create a tremendous amount of dysfunction within his family. Any of you who have had to deal with stepmoms and stepdads and stepbrothers and stepsisters, even if there is just a few of the stepfolks, know how complex this can become. And I think what David was saying to Solomon was, it's not just that you're going to need some strength with your responsibilities, but you're going to need some strength with how to handle relationships well. Because these, as you know, growing up in our house, are often very complex and painful. But what we have so far is impact, remembering what's important and moving, some kind of strength, carrying something heavy or weighty. And then we come to Ephesians 5:28, where Paul talks about sacrificial love. In Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. And most guys, if you've been around church a while and you've done some study on marriage, you know that verse. You know you're supposed to sacrifice. But the way we think about sacrifice, sacrificial love, is different from how a woman thinks about sacrificial love. And when it finally comes down to it, as a husband, it really doesn't matter what I think sacrificial love looks like. What really matters is what she thinks sacrificial love looks like. Now, my dad, I remember several conversations that I overheard with my mom and dad, where my mom was asking for a certain kind of love from my dad, and my dad just did not get this at all. She was asking for something on the personal level, and what his response was, I work 60, 70 hours a week. I provide you everything you and the kids need. What more could you ask from me? That was a poor question to address to his wife. But it's a question that often that's how it seems to us guys. Now, a few verses later, the kind of sacrificial love needed, he spells out. At the end of verse 28, he says, he nourishes and cherishes his wife as Christ does the church. To nourish a woman is something along the lines of giving life to or giving food to in the relational sense. There's something of you just sit down and you're listening to her day, and there's something about that that just interests you. And what you're hoping as a husband is that something in her comes alive as I'm interested in who she is. It's not because of what I know, or it's not because of my work. It's not because of my education. It's something entirely personal. Just the two of us. For guys, it's a lot like how you related when you were friends and you were dating. Or when you started to fall in love. You just liked being with her. And you were doing nourishing. Cherishing is, I think of this as the princess question that a woman asks. Am I still a princess to you? And the answer is not a logical answer. Well, yes, you'll always be my princess. I wouldn't have married you if I didn't think you'd be my princess. Now she's more convinced than ever that she's not. I've been there, done that. The princess question is really answered in a woman's heart by things like your smile and your attention and your two ears as you're listening. But it's not just that you're a passive participant, but there's something in you that's moving towards her. You're sort of advancing the relationship like you did when you were dating. And there's something in a woman's heart that comes alive as this happens. Sacrificial love. All of these are pictures of a man on the move with some amount of strength, with something important in mind to make a particular kind of impact in the people in his life, including his wife and his kids. On the inside of your handout, there's an image of this that I think is pretty cool. Last week we talked about how femininity, and one of the images of this is Jesus' invitational love. Come to me, all you who are weary, heavy laden, stressed out, and I will give you rest. Come to me. Unburden yourself. Come down and enjoy a place of rest. Now, when a woman provides that kind of relationship, that's what Peter describes as inner beauty. There's just something joyful and delightful that comes out of a woman's heart when she thinks that way. She's reflecting something of Jesus' invitational love. Now, when a man is strong on the move, what he's reflecting is something of the incarnational love of God and of Jesus moving into the lives of the people in his life with the purpose of providing blessing. And if he runs into any obstacles along the way, usually his own obstacles, he's going to sacrifice himself and his needs to try to touch or make an impact in the people around him. There's an example of this in Exodus chapter 2. During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery. They'd been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. And they cried out, their cry for help, because their slavery went up to God. And then notice four things, God's response to their groaning. He heard their groaning. He remembered, and it's the same word, it's male, Zakar. He remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac and Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites, and he was concerned about them. The idea is he knew it was time to act. This is the prelude to the call to Moses to go and to get the Hebrews out of Egypt. Now, this is a good metaphor for what we're talking about with masculinity. Is as a man, what you're doing is you are hearing the people in your life. Sometimes they're groaning or their fears, their anxieties. And you're not trying to fix anything. You're not trying to make any kind of comment. But that it makes an impact on you. You hear that. You remember how God moves towards you. He looked on the Israelites, meaning as a husband or a father, particularly of daughters. I'm pondering what's going on with my wife here. What is she struggling with? What are my daughters struggling with? And it's not that I necessarily have anything that I'm going to fix or advice. I'm going to avoid those things like the plague. But there's something that still wants to move toward them relationally. And then he says it's time to act. Sometimes it's just time to do more listening or to ask more questions. Or time to reach over and take a hand. Or to give a hug. Or to say, I'm so sorry you're having to deal with this. That's masculinity. Those are pictures of masculinity. And when, as husbands, we do things as simple as those things, there's something that comes alive in the heart of a wife and of daughters. Now, what derails our masculinity? Same thing that derails femininity, and that is fear. Fear is what derails us as guys. This goes all the way back to Genesis 3, Garden of Eden, when God says to Adam about the world we're going to live in, just like we looked at last week with the world that you ladies live in, where you are the deepest pain is going to be with your closest relationships. What you're going to see is a man's deepest pain is not the same as yours. It is very different. And if you ladies expect that your husband is going to have the same sort of angst about how your son is being bullied that you have, or your daughter's rejection, that he should have the same kind of angst that you have, you don't know your guy very well. We are really different creatures. We live in different worlds, in a sense, which is, let's look at Genesis 3. One other word before I read these verses. If you are a mother of a son, the words we're going to look at here give you an x-ray of your son's soul. If you're married, have a husband, the words we're going to look at give you an x-ray of your soul, your husband's heart or soul. Now, it's likely that your husband or son is not going to be able to put this into words, or even if he could, that he wants to. That's because we're guys. We are wired up very, very differently. But these are important words to understand and concepts if you're going to mother a son well and wife a husband well. Genesis 3. God says to Adam, cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat of it all the days of your life. Now remember, a woman's greatest pain with her husband and with her kids. That is not true with a man. Sometimes those are very painful things. Sometimes it's painful being a husband. Sometimes it's painful being a father. But generally speaking, there are deeper pains that I deal with and most men deal with that he talks about right here. It has to do with our work and what we're trying to do. Verse 18. It will produce thorns and thistles for you. If you've been over to our house, we have a bougainvillea out front. We have a bougainvillea out back. And yesterday, I went out to try to trim back one of the bougainvilleas. And I have these little thorn things all over my hands, even though I was wearing leather gloves. I don't know how it gets through leather. On my arms, I even have one here that was bleeding this morning when I was in the shower. Don't know how that happened. But every time I try to cut back a bougainvillea bush, this happens. I'm reminded of this verse. This is the world I live in. Not just this is bad news for gardeners or farmers. And thistles. When I think of that word, I think of weeds. Now, what's he saying here? Thorns and thistles for you, you will eat the plants of the field. What's he saying? It's not just bad news for farmers or gardeners. What he's saying is that every son of Adam is going to go into his field and he's going to find this a very frustrating adventure. When I was a kid, somewhere, I remember my mother asking me, would you go weed the front garden with flowers? I said, sure. Wasn't that big. How hard could that be? Took me about 6 or 7 minutes, got all the weeds up. I'm like, great, went off to play. Well, a few days later, I was walking up to our house and I noticed that there were more weeds growing. And I was very perplexed by that because I had just picked up a bunch of those and put them in the trash. And a few days later, as the weekend was coming up, my mom said, before you can go out and play, you need to weed the front bed with the flowers. I said, Mom, I got a question. I did that last Saturday. Why are they back? And she gave me the answer that every one of you already know I'm going to say. You got to get the roots. And she gave me this long garden tool with a long thing and a little fork at the end. And she said, you got to reach down parallel to the plant, go down deep, and then kind of pop it up like this and reach down and pull it out by the roots. So the next time I went out there and I did that. It took me a few minutes longer to weed this particular flower garden. I got all the weeds and put them in the trash, and I was thinking, yeah, got it. A few days later, of course you already know what's going to happen, they're growing back. And every Saturday, for a long time, my job was to go weed the front garden with the flowers. Now, that's a metaphor for the life that your husband and your son lives in. And it goes something like this. I see some of the most minute problems that should be able to be taken care of very simply. And yet when I give myself to them, it's never quite done. The problem is never solved the way I want it to be. I have to keep giving myself to the same problem over and over and over and over again. And that is very frustrating. Now, after a while of doing that over and over and over again, especially with bigger problems, it's easy to feel like, not just that it's frustrating, but the second F, feel like a failure. Do I have what it takes to do this? I don't seem to be doing very well at this thing of husbanding. I don't seem to be doing all that well with my teenagers. My parents are sick, and they're asking for more time, and my sister and brother think I need to give more time to my parents, and I can't take more time away from my work. And the car keeps messing up, and I got to put a new transmission in. And after a while of living in this world, there's a third F that's added to this for a man. It's not just frustrating. And there's not just a sense of failure, but the third thing is futility. Why even bother anymore? I'm so tired of failing. So tired of looking at myself in the mirror and thinking not good enough. I'm so tired of people demanding or asking more of me than it seems like I can give or that I know how to give, and then feeling like a failure because I haven't done enough. I'm so tired of that. I just want to drive off somewhere where nobody sees me. Now, ladies, your son is not going to tell you this is his inner world. And your husband is not going to tell this to you about his inner world. because it would just discourage the living daylights out of you if you knew this. So he does what most of us do, is we go back to our cave. We just pull away, and we're just going to hide back here, and we pretend out here that things are going just fine. But inside, there are questions of, I just don't know if I have what it takes, and I really don't know what the use is. Now, what particular fear is this? I think the right word is weightlessness. Remember, we were designed to move with strength to make an impact on people and on responsibilities. And what it seems to me like is when I try to do that, I make no impact. I make no dents. I make no dings. I'm sort of like Sandra Bullock in the movie Gravity. I just seem to be kind of weightless, floating along, trying to do something and not able to make an impact with anything of importance. This is the deep inner struggle that God tells us from the very beginning. This is the world your men live in. This is the world I live in. And guys, this is the world you live in. The weightless man. Paul says, I've tried everything and nothing helps. I'm at the end of my rope. Is there no one who can do anything for me? Isn't that the real question? Now, when you ask this question as a man, there are three different ways that guys tend to kind of move towards counterfeit manhood. Instead of courage and strength, trusting God and moving to make a difference, whether I get it right or not, whether it's manageable or comfortable or easy or pleasurable or especially pleasurable on demand, we'll move in one of three directions. The first is the shallow man. All right, tell me what to do. I'll do it. I'll get it right. But don't expect me to connect deeply with you or with anybody, because I just don't know how to do that. So that's the life. Sorry, that's all I can do. Shallow man. At least reward me for trying to do something right. The second kind is secular man. This is the man who's going to focus on what is it I do well. This is the story you heard of me in childhood. What is it I do well that's manageable in some ways that I can display for others to see that they'll think, hey, that's a pretty sharp guy. And then what I will draw the conclusion on is that's manhood. That makes me feel like a man my strengths. The third kind is the selfish man, who's virtually given up on moving with strength towards particularly people, difficult people, or difficult responsibilities. And he's so tired of frustration and failure and sense of futility that what his heart says is, I'm so tired of feeling that way, I'm just going to do whatever it takes to feel better now. I don't care if it's right or wrong. And where a guy usually goes to is the realm of lust or porn. What's so attractive about porn? I know you ladies don't get this, and it's very different for guys. What's so attractive about porn? What's attractive to a man about porn is this. I can feel like a man without having to act like a man. I get the benefits of my design, my physical design, and my sexual design, and looking at the screen, somebody wants me in a way that doesn't require anything of me of courage or sacrifice or of love or on the move toward this person as a person to develop deeply with. And so that becomes the only place for some men, virtually, where they feel something of what it means to be a man. Now, what does it mean to be a Christian man? What does this look like? Well, I think the image is not the victorious Christian life that you sometimes hear. I grew up hearing as a young Christian, or the mountaintop experience of going to camp and feeling close to God. Those are good things. I like those when that happens. That's good, but that's really not the image of manhood in this life, post Garden of Eden with the three F's. Paul says, "I've tried everything. Nothing helps. I'm at the end of my rope. Is there no one who can do anything for me?" Isn't that the real question? What you see in Romans chapter 7 is Paul wrestling with himself. wrestling with his own nature. I don't get this. Why do I do the things I know I shouldn't do? And why don't I do the things I know I should do? Of course, thankfully, chapter 8 begins with, "Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord." There is an answer that has to do with a vertical look, not a horizontal look. It's very easy in our culture, our Christian culture, to idealize the Christian life. And to sort of set ourselves up for this level, this bar, at which I should be able to jump 18 feet in high jump, but I can't seem to get above about 3 feet. Easy to do that. I like what Charles Haddon Spurgeon said. This is in your handout. This is probably the greatest Christian I know of the 19th century. Tremendous, one of the greatest preachers of the 19th century in London. This is what he wrote. "I know nothing about the wonderful experience of freedom from conflict and complete deliverance from every evil tendency within himself." Not an idealized version of Christianity here. "I have never won an inch of the way to heaven without fighting for it." Does this ring a bell? That's certainly my testimony. "I have never lived a day, but I have had sorrow over my imperfection." Welcome to the club. "I sometimes get near to God," then notice what he says next, "but at that time I weep most for my faults and failings." In other words, what he does is, as he, instead of pretending that life is better than it is, or pretending that he's better than it is, he takes an honest look at himself, and when he does that, the silver lining is it propels him Godward. "I need something that I cannot provide for myself if I'm going to be a man in the design that God has for me." 2 Corinthians 1, Paul gives the same testimony. "I did not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about the hardships we suffered in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life." Now, there are times I could have written that verse. And there are times a lot of you could have written that verse. You know something of that reality. What do we do as men? I think we really have two choices. We either pretend that life is better and I'm better than I really am. If there's a problem relationally, I'm going to likely blame somebody else. If they have a problem with me, it's not me. And I'm going to slowly sort of adjust myself to make sure that whatever pleasure makes me feel good, that's on my radar. And it's usually pleasure on demand. The second one is to acknowledge the world I live in. It's a fallen world. And to acknowledge that there are times where I feel a tremendous amount of frustration, and times I feel like a failure, and there are times where just a sense of futility, I just don't have what it takes to do the different things in my life and responsibilities and relationships the way people think I should, the way I should think I should, to acknowledge that, to embrace that, and what that does is it drives me to God. Now, God, I'm over my head here, and what we'll find is down deep in the depths of your heart, that's where masculinity finally becomes alive or central. You realize that God moves toward you regardless of the mess you are, regardless of the mess I am. Maybe everybody else has given up on me. Maybe I've given up, but he hasn't. And when I sense once again God's strong movement towards me, I matter to him. There's something in me that says, huh, that's pretty good. I think that's what I need. And now I think my wife needs to taste some of that through me. My two daughters need some of that through me. My son needs that through me. There are people in our church that need that as I relate to them. And there's something in me that wants to move like God does towards the people in my life and towards the responsibilities in my life, even if I'm confused about how to do that, and even though I'm not sure if I really have what it takes. That doesn't matter. I just need to move towards people and relationships, trusting God that whatever I need, he's going to provide, and if I can't see what is provided, that I'm going to live in the confusion of that, and I'm still going to put my best foot forward in these two arenas. There's something of that's what Christian maturity as a man looks like. And Paul has this image on the back of your handout in Ephesians chapter 6, where he talks about the spiritual warfare. And he talks about putting on the whole armor of God. What does the victor at the end of a battle look like? Standing on the mountaintop, excited? Hey, let's order some chocolate chip cookies and some coffee and have a party. Now, after a battle where you didn't have breakfast because the battle started so early in the morning, and you fought all the way through lunch, and you fought all the way from dinner, you fought from sunup until after sundown, and your left hand was a shield, which you were trying to ward off arrows and sword thrusts and a battle axe from one huge guy named Igor. And in your right hand, you had a sword that you wielded all day. When the sun goes down and the battle finally stops and the fog of war finally dissipates and the smoke from the cannons and the musket fire slowly starts to fade away with a gentle breeze, the victor is the one who's just standing. He doesn't necessarily feel like a victor. He doesn't feel like, I really have something to take. All you can say about him is he's still standing. And he's lived to fight another day. That's masculinity. That's what we're called to as men. And as we do that, then we reflect something of the wonder of God. Now, I want to finish with just a little blurb here to both you ladies and men. Because this relates. What's the cycle of internal and relational change? How do we release the femininity that's already in you, ladies? How do I release the masculinity that's already in me? And it seems to me it goes through this cycle. There's the cycle of longing. There's something I long for in relationship with someone else. And it seems like it ought to come through. And then the second thing that happens is some matter of disappointment. The person doesn't come through like you thought they should, and over a long period of time, this gets more and more disappointing. The third level is, we should have this on, there we go. The third level is hunger, is that we start to look upward for something that our heart yearns for on the horizontal realm. And we begin to, the fourth one, is encounter God at a little bit deeper level than we had before. And for you ladies, it's something of the invitational love of Jesus for you that delights in you as a person. Or for guys, that God is on the move towards you with strength because you matter. And there's something, number five, where you want to reflect that to the people in your life. And then lastly, there's a longing that says, the first longing at the top of that list was a longing to get something relationally. The second longing is, there's a growing longing in me. There's something more important than what I'm going to get, and that's what I'm going to give as a man. It's more important than what I'm going to get as a man. And for you ladies, there's something more important that you're going to give as you relate to the people in your life than what you're going to get. And then the cycle begins all over again. Over and over and over through the course of our life, each time deepening through that. Let's pray together. Father, I wish I had a magic wand, and for all of us, whether last week for the ladies or this week for us guys, that we could see inside of the design of how you've made us as people. And in spite of our fears, whether as kids or as youth or adults, whatever our painful experiences were, as children, youth, or adults, if we could see the design that is inside of us clearly, and then if we would embrace what is true, rather than run to try to create something different, we would discover the wonder of who you are and the real center of life. But these things require courage and humility and sacrifice and being other-centered. things of which we are in short supply. Please meet us, each one of us today, as if you were in every chair, sitting right next to us. A place of rest for the ladies in this room, where somebody delights in you, somebody strong that's already sacrificed himself on a cross for you. And for every guy who knows what you did last week that nobody else knows and still would not be in any other place except sitting next to you today to enjoy your company, to call you brother.